time on Still Waters. This is NB506812, narrowcasting into the night from somewhere on Britain's waterways.
February 24th, Saturday. Cloud cliffs, grey and climbing. Early spring sunshine, catching the stonework traceries and Benedictine flint and brickwork. The hub of politicking and commerce silenced by the wheel turn of centuries. Now trees stand where monks walked, and daffodils nod in silent prayer. An hour of gentle talk and laughter among such emerald greens of spring. The crows bathe in the Stiffkey Brook as the wayside flames with primrose, crocus and snowdrop. And later, vast flights of wild geese fly south along the coastline. The wind has now changed, but it's still raw and bitter. There's a smudge of a waning moon that appears as if the sleeve has brushed against it while it was still wet. Two ducks sit on the bankside alongside us, hunched figures in the night. Below them, the water shivers. This is the Narrowboat Erica, narrowcasting into the dark, to you, wherever you are. It's not as cold tonight as it has been, but there's rain in the air, and there is a damp chill that cuts bone deep. So come inside and make yourself comfortable by the stove. The kettle is on, the welcome is warm, and I'm so glad that you could make it tonight. Welcome aboard. For most of this week so far, there's been a rough northeasterly wind, raw and bitter. It's raked the water's surface into scallops and flung pebbles of rain against the boat. I've been grateful for the stoves. But the week has also had an early spring-like feel to it. Up in Norfolk, daffodils, crocus and primrose are blooming in the cloud-chased sunshine. Bullace and blackthorn and cherry plum foam thick and white along the roadside. Things are a little later here, though. But the swans are courting again, circling, necks entwined, forming serpentine heart shapes. And the scattering of twigs show that the rooks are busy with their nests. Between the recording of the last episode and its uploading, we had news from Dad's doctor to inform us that he's now being treated as an end-of-life patient, and further care is going to be palliative. It's not a huge shock, and we'd all read the signs, and in some ways it's made things a little easier as we weren't having to second-guess what was happening to him. But it does mean that once more, our weekly and monthly schedules are rather up in the air, and trying to be with Dad as much as possible. And also, keeping with the old adage, it never rains but it pours, the central heating on the boat has just packed up. And normally it wouldn't have mattered at all, as we use it really only in late spring and early autumn when mornings and evenings are a little bit chilly but it's too warm to light the stove. However, it's pretty essential at the moment, as we're obviously having to leave the boat for 3 to 4 days and we can't leave the stoves running. I guess that's a bit of an exaggeration. It's not essential, but it does make life a hell of a lot easier. It also provides a good way to keep the pipes from freezing during very cold snaps. And of course, this last weekend, when we were away, wouldn't you know it, but the nighttime temperatures plunge below zero. But I'm impinging on a topic for a future episode that I've planned, one that answers a couple of questions that Lee has sent me. So I'll stop there. And it's been lovely to receive so many of your comments, and thank you all for your good wishes for Dad. And again, thank you for being patient with the tardiness of my replies at the moment. And it was so lovely to connect so unexpectedly with Liz on X or Twitter. And I'm not sure if you listen to this, Liz, but thank you for dropping in to see Dad. He really appreciated it. And thank you for dropping me a line, Barry and the fans. It's lovely to hear from you. And of course, thank you, Lee, and more from Lee in a future episode. And thank you and hello also to Kaz Sargent and Captain Arlo and MJ and to Anna McKellar. And Anna, I'm really glad that you like the readings from JM Singh from the last episode. And Sam, not many people have heard of Singh today, so it's wonderful to hear that you have a copy of his book in translation. And I'm so pleased that you also enjoy his writings. And over on Facebook, hello and thank you to Cheryl Davidson and LJ and Bodie. That looks like a lot of snow over there, LJ. I bet Bodie's loving it. Maggie has yet to experience any real snow here. And hello also to Tracy Thomas and to Jason Polite and to Anna Vaughan and Tony Rutherford. Thank you both for your very kind words and your best wishes. And also a very special thanks to all our Lockwheelers for supporting this podcast. They are Chris and Alan on NB Land of Green Ginger, Captain Arlo, Rebecca Russell, Alison on the Narrowboat Mucker, Derek and Pauline Watts, Anna V, Orange Cookie, Donna Kelly, Mary Keane, Tony Rutherford, Arabella Holtzapfel, Rory with MJ and Kayla, the Narrowboat Precious Jet, Linda Reynolds-Birkins, Richard Noble, Carol Ferguson, Tracy Thomas, Mark and Tricia Stowe, and Madeline Smith. Thank you. Do you remember all of those walks that we used to have, Dad? Scatterdells, Whippindale, looking for orchids on Roughdown Common, bracken-scented ash ridge, the amber and blue mists of Tolkien-esque Chorleywood Common, Tring Reservoirs, the Apostle's Pond in Chipperfield Woods, the rushing River Chess at Cheney's, the dolphining spine of Ivanhoe, the kite-soaring slopes of Coombe Hill. And the four of us, loosely strung out along the footpaths and winding lanes, like a broken charm bracelet. And in my memory, it was often damp, the air leathery with mushroom and wet wood, perhaps at times edged with a nip of early frost. And the light dimming, and the wintry sky softened with a hazy mist turning salmon pink and then to rose. And you and Mum chatting together, you with your wooden camera case, Mum clutching her copy of Kebble Martin, Wendy and I lost deep in our own silent worlds. Soon darkness will fall. We had a bit of a reputation, didn't we, Dad, among family, friends and relations, that any walk with us would involve coming back in the dark with no torch and crossing at least one muddy field in the pitch black. They never really learnt, though, did they? And even in your older years, when you moved up here to Wells, and you and Mum took Don and Joan for a quick stroll down to the beach dunes, and then ended up having to race the oncoming tide by ploughing through the sea mud, with Don still wearing his meticulously polished city brogues. I think Donna only really felt truly part of our family after we led a youth group on a circular walk in Devon. And even though it was clearly marked, being conscientious, we decided to go round it together first. However, to my eyes, the beginning was much more climactic than the end, and so when it came to actually taking the youth on it, I decided that it would be much better to do it backwards, in the dark, without torches. At one point, the route became very rugged and involved a lot of clambering. But when we were on higher ground, getting a sense of direction of where we were, I recognized a large boulder that I had spotted and made a note of on our practice circuit. But as we walked up to it, it got to its feet and ambled off to join the rest of the cows a little further down the hill. Our family walks always tended to be a little like that. A quick diversion to explore something new, or a choice of a slightly different path. And they would end up being just a little too long, walking back home in fading light, footsore and stiffening legs. And it wasn't that our walks were designed to be marathons of endurance. Oh, we climbed Snowdon a couple of times, and the trail from Clamberis seemed to be endless, but our goals were never really notable, not when compared with the lists found in walking guides or Sunday supplements. And Hike Up Nick, Teesdale, became our family code word for a mammoth walk. "We're not going up Hike Up Nick, are we, today?" became our plea when a family walk was suggested. But I suppose the one that epitomizes all of this was on our family holiday in Wales. And I think shortly after arriving at the cottage that we'd rented, we decided to take a stroll up a nearby mountain, the Drum. And in all honesty, I don't remember too much of it. I think I was around 8 or 9 at the time. But I do remember long rising flanks of wind-blown tall grass, white sky, a group of mountain ponies, their manes wild and flailing. There's a photographic slide of me somewhere, and although it's high summer, it's cold, and I'm standing awkwardly on a featureless rise of ground. My hands are behind my back, as I'm wearing a pair of socks on them, as we did not have any gloves with us. "Where did those socks come from, Dad? Whose socks am I wearing?" It's one of those times when what looks like a short distance on the map turned out to be much, much longer. Actually, I'm not sure whether we even bothered with the map. We just saw a high point and thought, "Let's walk to the top, savour the views and blow away the cobwebs before tea time." It was one of my first introductions to the false summit and the siren call of high places that draws the unwary ever on. But what I do remember really well is that long walk home to our holiday cottage. It felt never-ending. And even when we at last reached the front door and the keys were being found, I remember that I kept walking on the spot. And Mum asked what I was doing, and I replied that I was worried that if I stopped walking, I would never be able to start again. And apparently, I curled up in an armchair and fell soundly asleep and didn't wake up until the next morning. Most of our walks were like that, weren't they? Culminating in long walks home, trying to beat the failing light, tired legs, and the pooling darkness of dusk. But of course, there's always a tea waiting to be eaten at home when we return. Sandwiches, or in winter, toast, and the crisp tang of celery sticks that we would bite on and dip the end in little egg cup of salt. The proper season for celery is when you have to draw the curtains closed for tea time, and it still feels wrong eating celery when it's daylight outside. There were also those special times when we had tea in the front room and the fire would be on and the radio on, Sing Something Simple. It was always Sing Something Simple. Or even better, we would play our records and we'd all read our books while we ate toast and cake. And outside, the gloaming grew thick and dark. And now, that time has come again, the long walk home as the darkness begins to fall, a tenebrae darkness, a sheltering darkness of the night behind the night. Feeling that familiar seep of heaviness in your legs, the hot rub of heel and sole with every step, and a few miles still to go in the shadows of the gathering night. For now, the day has at last grown old, Dad, and I know that you know it. You've said it already in 100 little ways, and that daylight is beginning to fade. The shadows growing long and dark, melding and deforming the known, the familiar. Perspectives get distorted, as they always do. It's been a long walk, hasn't it, Dad? We've been to some good places, seen and done wonderful things, laughed so much that our ribs have ached and tears fell. Felt the warmth of sunshine and our beating hearts. And now the time has come, however reluctantly, as we've had to do so many, many times before, we've now got to turn for home once more. True to form, perhaps it feels just a little too long a walk. But then the best ones, the ones that we fondly remember the most, High Cup Nick, the drum, Jack Scar, or that last walk that you and I and Penny took along the beach, over the dunes to Holcombe Bay. And even though the sky is darkening toward the east, those spontaneous diversions, those fox trails we followed not knowing where we'd end up, they were worth it, weren't they? And even though the exhaustion has set in, and the daylight is dimming, once more, for one final time, we're here together. You and me, Donna and Wendy and Andrew, and even Mum in her own way, walking back home together in the fading light. And I know that you feel so tired, and the anxieties that can pour into this world that was once so familiar but is now filled with shifting shadows that distort and make strange the world that you once knew. And so it's not surprising that you at times feel a little lost, alone, and so far from home. But we've got this, Dad. Try not to worry or be afraid. The time has come for me to find the way home, just this once, as you have done so many, many times for me. Times when the darkness has pressed in, and all I could do was to follow the long strides of your footprints. You always found the way, and now it's my turn. And that's how it should be. So don't be afraid of the darkness as it comes. I will find the way back home. In this closing light of gathering night, shadows shift and change. They can be disorienting, confusing. And it's so easy to feel lost in a familiar landscape, where what is safe, trusted, comforting, lurches and tilts in alarming ways, and nothing seems quite what it once was. And our relationship dance and whirl in unthinkable and unimagined ways. For in this fading light, we see each other differently, and we look different. Our relationships alter, shapeshift, roles swap about and swap again. Father, son, son, father. Two men in company with each other, looking for the path back home in a dark world. Perhaps it's just that this dimming light plays tricks with us. Or perhaps it just helps us to see things as they really are. But this last year, it's become easier to see below the surface of the man to the younger you. I have always been so proud to have you as my dad, and perhaps that's something you never really knew. But now I can glimpse the young boy that must have always lived deep within the man. That cycling shifts within our roles strip away the years, and I can recognize how like the young you, the young I was. And as you cared and protected the young me, I can now do that for you. And I think I can also glimpse how much your mother, Chick, and father, Grampy, must have loved you so much. And as you lie in your nestling bed, a little figure propped up by pillows, I see you through Chick's eyes, busy around the house, keeping a worried eye on you, and Grampy, coming in from work, popping his head around the door as I do. How's Michael doing? And in doing so, I can feel the deep well of how much they loved you. And that was mirrored in your deep love for us. And is this what the process of dying really does? It gently eases away those hardened carapaces that we have spent our lives constructing. Hard shells that protect the tiny, vulnerable us that hides deep within. The roles we have chosen and the ones that have been chosen for us. The armor of adulthood that we have nurtured to stop the things that hurt and to cover the wounded parts of us. Is in our dying just the stripping away of the layers for us to emerge in all our undefended core of unadorned humanness once more? Perhaps we should have lived a little more like that, hold on to that stage a little longer. And then these undoings wouldn't feel quite so perplexing, so awkward, alien. It wouldn't feel so much like the unraveling of a life, just the revealing of one. Is this the purpose of dying? To prepare us for death? The apocalypse, in its original sense, of the true self, distilled into the fragile vulnerability of who we truly are. It seems as if there is a need to leave this life in the same state that we entered it, and that only our true selves can take us into the sweeping waters of the great unknown. The chrysalises of our making have outlived their usefulness. And once more, we are being set free to be who we are born to be. I suppose it's a very human response to shrink away from this process, to view it as in some way being wrong, to fight it, to be afraid of it. That appears to misunderstand what is happening. This is not contraction. It's not a decline or a lessening to become something that is less than what we were before. It's about bringing us to the point where we are more than what we were before. Distilled, refined, the essence, for good or ill, of who we really are. Surely that's not something to be fought against, but to be embraced. So don't be afraid of this process, Dad. It's natural. And it's right. You see, we have the misfortune of being born into a culture that does growing old and dying so very, very badly. How can we make such a hash of something that's so universal, so much part of our existence, so normal and so natural? I know you love Dylan Thomas as much as I do, but his Rage, Rage Against the Dying of the Light got it so wrong. It was the voice of a young man's anger confronted with the brute existence of death. It's not the voice of one who understands the truth of life and existence. There is nothing unnatural in our dyings. There's nothing wrong about what is happening to you, Dad. It's part of that natural rhythm and the ebb and the flow. So try not to be alarmed. Your body is just doing what it needs to do. As uncomfortable and as debilitating and at times painful as that is. Listen to it. Trust it as you have done throughout your life. It will not harm you. And that turning in of your world, the diminishing of your interests, your visions, this is all part of it. It's the nature of twilight to foreshorten the horizon, to narrow our fields of view. This is normal and as natural as flame drawn from the fire or blackbird's song at first light. And with it, that sense of becoming detached from the world around. Donna calls this process becoming unanchored, and that's a good word for it. There are other tides, other currents for you to discover, for you to float away on. The withdrawing is part of all of this. Do you remember when you were in hospital and we talked about how Kismaspuss appeared to know that she was about to die? And how she took herself out of the house and walked to the top of the garden to be alone? And how she made herself a simple nest in the warmth of the compost heap, curled up and gently died? It was my very first encounter with death, that was. Although I knew it theoretically, that day I knew that I lived in a world where everything will die. And I always thought that that was Kismas's greatest lesson for me. But I don't think that it's quite true, for she brought a bigger, more important lesson. For she taught us how to die. And since then, I've come across thanatology, the study of non-predation death among non-human lives. And this impulse to draw, to find a quiet place and solitude, to make a nest, appears to be one of the constants across many different species. This deep-seated urge to withdraw, this diminishing, this unanchoring from your world. It's entirely natural to unloose all of those knots that tie you here and to seek solitude and quietness. Giving in to that impulse to seek the quiet and the shadowed light, to find a nest and to burrow down in its warmth and protection, just as Kismas did. You're doing it right, Dad. Even in its discomfort and disconcerting foreignness, this is the path not to be feared any more than the seed being broken by the frost or leaf fall or the dying back of summer grass. And I know that deep down you do not fear it, but instead recognize its appropriateness and its rightness. Follow Kismaspuss, Dad. She's helping you to find the path home. And so, we find ourselves at last at the end of a very long walk, and the night is falling. And we all knew this time will come, and now it's here. And I know you feel so tired, Dad, and the anxieties that can push away the sleep and fill your nighttime hours, and how this world, once so familiar, is now filled with disconcerting, shifting shadows. I know that you must still feel lost. But we got this, Dad. Try not to worry. Close your eyes and let me take the lead. And there is a path in this landscape of no paths, and I will find it. Although sometimes I do feel a bit lost, as you must do. And I know I'm going to get it wrong at times, and I'm sorry. A misjudged action, word. But please know that it comes from a depth of love for you. And Donna and Wendy each have much more experience and knowledge in this than I do, and they too are walking with us, finding their own paths to match your steps. But the one thing at this point of which I am certain is that the pathless path that we do find and walk along will be exactly the right one. So now the trails of wild geese are calling across the sullen skies, and the air is chill with damp. We're tired and footsore. But there's the glow of lamplit windows in the distance, and soon we'll see a rise of terraced houses with chimney smoke winding upwards between the wiry forest of television aerials, their roof slates silvered with rain. It's not far now, Dad. Just a little while more, and we'll be home. I'll walk with you up to the door, but for now, only you can walk through it. My turn will come when it's the right time. But please know that I will always be just on the other side of it, for however long it takes. I won't be far away, as you won't be far from me. But don't worry about me, Dad. I have paths of my own to walk, and things to see, and a person to become. And I too will also have my time of unloosing and unanchoring, and I'll be all right. But don't say don't be sad, don't miss me, for 'cause I will. Parting and goodbyes hurt, and they never really stop hurting, do they? But again, it's natural and normal, and it's how life is. And so, we will walk back home together as the light fades for one more time. And we will joke about not bringing a torch, although secretly we'll be glad that this sheltering night is not disturbed by artificial light. And it's as it should be, the end of a very good and a very long walk. And now it's time for rest. And I'll leave a light on the stairs for you.